Islamic revolution. Of course, this revolution is a rough translation for what happened as Inqilab in Iran, because usually revolution has a negative connotation, but this Inqilab was a change, a political change, social change, religious change inside Iran. And now we know it, this country, all across the world, the United Nations, by the name Islamic Republic of Iran, or the Islamic Republic of Iran. Okay, brothers, let's get to some of the most important values and the concepts which were introduced by the late Imam Khomeini in the new political system of Iran, Islamic Republic of Iran. Brother Ali Alavian, let's start with you. At the very beginning, the people chanted in Iran, in Farsi, I say it, Istiqlal Azadi Jumhuri Islami. If you want to roughly translate it, it would be Independence, Freedom, Islamic Republic. Independence and freedom from what? And what kind of freedom the people were looking for?
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. May Allah's peace and blessings be upon the Holy Prophet of Islam, Muhammad, and his immaculate progeny. There are different kinds of freedom that we can talk about, and also independence actually is quite clear, and inshallah I shall comment on that as well. And it will lead, I mean, from this freedom and also independence, we will be led to Islamic Republic. By freedom, actually, different kinds of freedom are looked at. One is individual freedom, and also civil freedom of the people, of the every single people in the nation. The people should be free to present, to say their own ideas and their ideas and rights, and also to write whatever they want to say, but within the limits of the Islamic framework. Mm-hmm. So this Islamic framework should be actually seen as a limit. So you might say that, okay, brother, you are limiting people from one side and tell them that you are talking about freedom. Look, the concept of freedom is not something absolute anywhere in the world or in anywhere. Freedom has been defined everywhere in the world. By freedom, actually, we believe that this freedom should have a framework for itself. And the framework of the freedom that we are talking about is to say whatever we like to say as a human being, up to the point that it does not actually damage and hurt the Islamic values. So this freedom actually has been defined. And if we look at in the Islam, so what is the border, what are the borders of this freedom? Human beings are free to say whatever they like, and in case they are saying something or want to present something, to write something against the pillars of the religion.
Is it really the true meaning of freedom Imam Khomeini was after? When we are talking about Azadi and freedom in the religious sense of the matter, it encompasses a broader, we can say, arena and scope. When we are talking about spiritual freedom and religious freedom, it does not necessarily mean to be free and do whatever you like, but it means to be free from, we can say, the materialistic mundane world which is around you. And also freedom from the chains of the capitalism and liberalism on that time. Mm-hmm. Wasn't this Azadi that Imam Khomeini was after and coming and being juxtaposed with Istiqlal, which is independence, was a kind of freedom from the, the chains and the shackles of the time? Because freedom means being free from the shackles and the chains. And at that time, we know that this hegemony that existed in the world wanted to rule over all the countries. Mm-hmm. Wasn't this freedom we talked about in Iran, we can say Imam Khomeini introduced it, can it be interpreted this way too?
Let's differentiate between these two kinds of freedom. Mm-hmm. Freedom that actually is for the whole state and for the whole nation. And it can be even interpreted as independence. And this independence is also a sort of freedom from mm-hmm. the, let's say, chain of the pressures of the pressures coming from outside. So this independence by itself is sort of freedom in the scale of a nation. But second kind of freedom that we are talking about is personal civil freedom, or let's say individual freedom, mm-hmm. that we are going to even talk about and pay attention to even in this session. So when we are saying istiqlal azadi, independence and freedom, so the first kind is in the nation scale and the second is in an individual scale. Mm-hmm. So all the rights of the all human beings who are living in this country should be respected and should be valued. In Islam, humans are looked at as free in the sense that they can say whatever they want, but they should not nullify, but it should not nullify the borders of, let's say, logic, the borders of
humanitarian values,
the borders yeah. of humanitarian values. That's and right. whatever actually makes human great. Mm-hmm. So naturally the outcome of these two sorts of freedom will be a republic state, a republic government. Mm-hmm. So,
which is based on the people's vote.
Very true.
And this was, we can't say,
so in
the differentiation.
We say in the second form of freedom that we have been talking about, mm-hmm. in individual or civil freedom,
yes.
so the votes of the people are counted, taken into account. Mm-hmm. It means that people, unlike the previous regimes, that the people's vote were not seen based on lots of documents and evidences that mm-hmm. we see here, and they are available. The votes and the viewpoints of people were not looked at and were not actually respected. But we see
right.
that after 42 years of Islamic revolution, mm-hmm. more than 45 elections have been actually performed and
were conducted
in this country. Mm-hmm. And people see that even from the top, the toppest person, the most responsible person
yes.
in this government is
okay.
directly or indirectly elected by the people.
The president,
so they see the importance of their votes.
Okay.
But did we have such a thing even at the time of the kings before? So did we ourselves? I mean,
for sure, in the monarchy system, we did not have, because we had the prime minister.
Let's go down.
Yes.
I mean, to the lower levels.
Yes.
People did not see their no. power to change, for example, even a minister
yeah.
or to change a prime minister.
Okay.
So now they feel that they are a part of this society. So it does not mean that we don't have any deficiency
okay.
or any problem right. in this issue.
Thank you very much, Brother Ali Alavian. And Said Mohsen, do you believe that the people's role, we can say, in the fate and the destiny of the country was taken from the Islamic Sharia, or was it something based upon the political, we can say, values of the modernity? Because in the political values of the modernity, the voting system and the election, its own has, we can say, value. But for Imam Khomeini and for his school of thought, was this election that was done, was it something taken from the Western world or no? In Islamic system and in Islamic establishments and states, we had this system already.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Well, in Islam, we have a concept which is called being mabsutul yad.
Mm-hmm.
The word mabsutul yad is the Arabic terminology, which means that the ruler of the Islamic state should have an open hand.
Mm-hmm.
And whatever he orders, people must follow him. If I give you the example of the history, regardless of pointing about the dispute that we have in the history, why Imam Ali alayhi salatu wasalam, he spent 25 years in home? Because people of that time, or maybe the people who were around them, they did not allow him to basically freely govern the Islamic State after the Prophet, and they chose other people. So in other words, he wasn't Mabsutul Yad. He was Imam, he was the leader.
Mm-hmm.
He has that state from Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. But obviously, unless people do not follow the leader,
that's right.
he cannot apply all the Islamic, we can say, like...
And he respected them. This is beautiful.
Yes.
Yeah, he respected the people's idea, isn't it?
He respected.
Yes.
Why? Because obviously Imam, in order to apply the rules, he must have this, we can say, like... he must be in this state.
Yes.
why Imam Khomeini, when he came to Iran, the very first day he asked for the referendum? It was because if they are accepting him as a leader, as an Islamic leader of the state, or the Waliya Faqih, or the Faqih, or the leader, he must have an open hand in applying all the rules. And once they choose him, then he has to apply all the rules and they have to follow him. So that was the referendum.
That's right.
In the definition of democracy, generally it is stated that the system of government by the whole population or all the eligible members of the state, they are elected by the representatives.
Yes.
That's what it is said.
Yes.
In the Islamic, obviously, revolution, we see that the whole Islamic revolution, the values and the obviously the things that it had, it was under the Islamic Sharia, mm-hmm. number one. Within the Islamic Sharia says the people should be free. They should have the freedom. Obviously, they should be obviously have the spirituality. The means of spirituality should be provided to them. And the Islamic ruler should apply all the Islamic rules. Now, when we talk about the role of the people within the Islamic Sharia, within the Islamic context, it means that the leader is one. After that, obviously, people can choose a person who is aslah, who is pious, for example, who is a God-weary person, to be their representative and to manage their place.
The main difference with the democracy in the West is over here, because
yes.
in the electoral college electoral votes in now, for example, in the United States of America, we see that these elites and, as you said, representatives, we can say the main characteristics are not being Muslim or religious or something like that, okay? So the main difference over here is that in the Islamic Republic.
Yes.
That representative must be according...
Yes, we can see even at the time of the caliphates
mm-hmm.
Or even in the time of Imam Ali, there were people where the khulafa or the caliph, they used to send a representative to a place, being the governor.
Yes.
But in some places, people refused to accept him.
Mm-hmm.
And they said, we have a person who is better than him, we
mm-hmm.
think. So they respected this value.
Okay.
This respect is obviously, this gives a more, we can say, like power to the ruler.
That's right.
Of the time, of the state.
That's right.
So Imam Khomeini, being the leader of the Islamic revolution, he very first, obviously, he did the referendum.
That's right.
In order to know whether the people are accepting me, because this is one of the mean. Once you vote for something, you're
yes.
responsible for it.
Yes.
Once the whole nation voted for the Islamic state, Imam Khomeini announced it as the Islamic Republic, and that's
mm-hmm.
why it has the name of Republic of
yes.
there.
Republic.
It's not because
yeah.
like people
yeah.
they voted for Imam
yes.
and they unvoted Shah, for example,
mm-hmm.
the king,
mm-hmm.
or they voted for him. Being a leader, they said, we want the Islamic Republic, we want the Islamic State.
That's right.
Imam Khomeini named it as, in respect of people, he named it as Islamic Republic, because it's the nation, the whole nation wanted to be the Islamic
mm-hmm.
State.
Thank you much, Brother Ali Alavian and Said Mohsen Naqvi, for presence mm-hmm. in the program. Viewpoints and analysis on the thoughts and works of the Supreme Leader of Iran, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei. You can download for free our previous episodes of the program Viewpoints on our website, parstoday.com/en, Call of Islam page. Also, visit our YouTube page, Call of Islam Radio. To another episode, God bless you all. Fi amanallah.
كان وقام الإمام قام الإمام
قام الإمام
وقامت مرايا وكر الأنام كر الأنام
قام الإمام
جماهير إيران في صحوة تداعت إلى الساح وسط الزحام
وقامت أسوداً
لك بالخمين نداء السماء وغيث الغمام.
وعاد الإمام إلى أرضه ليملأ عدلا بلاد الكرام.
Aperture.
Welcome back to Aperture. In the first part of the program, we witnessed that abuse by law enforcement officers in the United States is one of the most serious and divisive human rights violations in the country, as U.S. police is killing black people at persistently high rates. What is clear is that racism is at the very heart of the issue, as statistics show that black people are 3 times more likely to be killed by police than white people. What is worse is that even black children are being targeted. Yet the people have not been silent. They have organized in what is known as the Black Lives Matter campaign to get the message across that all lives are of equal value, no matter the color of the skin. Stay with us for the rest of the program.
We're just going over some things for the vigil. It's going to be in Nicholas Hayward Jr. Park. That's in Brooklyn. He was murdered by the police. 13-year-old murdered by the police for like really similar circumstances, very close parallel to what was happening with what happened with Tamir Rice. So it's important for me, I think, that that place be chosen and that his story be highlighted.
So to that end, I'm always trying to connect the dots so that people see, yes, this is a national issue, but this is also a local issue. So his father's going to be speaking. We'll have a prayer by Pastor Omar, words from Mr. Hayward, I'm sorry, and then I'll close out talking about the national epidemic of police violence against children. And this is why I wanted us to meet, so that we could talk about things that I may be overlooking. For one, I've applied for a permit with the Parks Department. You guys know that's always important to me, but I also wanted to get your input on that. We had issues with the permit, with the march, lots of fighting with the Parks Department and the Police Department. And so they haven't been responsive yet, so I'm wondering if we're going to encounter the same issues that we did with the 4-mile march. The reason why I choose places of public accommodation is because we have a legal right to be there. And so, there's nothing that they can really do about us exercising our First Amendment right within a space of public accommodation.
Glad that the weather held up.
Thank God, because yesterday was terrible.
Yeah, I thought it was going to rain.
Imagine if yesterday would have been today.
Yeah, and lugging all of this stuff in the rain, and I know it would have been a terrible turnout. But
get ponchos.
Yeah. Exactly. But, people don't show up when it's rainy or cold, so I'm really glad that people have, I think we're going to have a good turnout.
So I'm really excited working with Leah because, you saw her. She's going to be having the weatherproof posters of the children and their stories.
She did a great job.
Yeah. I think that'll be powerful with it tied, on the fence so that passerbys, will wonder and come and look, and then they can read the stories.
Yeah, I'm excited about that. She also did an art installation on the floor where she got age-appropriate shoes, whatever size their shoe size would be at the age that they were killed, and she painted those white, and those are going to be there too. So it's going to really help you visualize how small these kids were when their lives were stolen.
And I think it's good to focus on the children because this is something that can't be argued.
Exactly.
Even you can play devil's advocate, but these are children.
Exactly.
Children are harmless.
Tamir Rice, 12 years old, playing with a toy gun in the park. The cops roll up on him, and in 2 seconds, they have killed him. 1001, 1002, Tamir is dead. And this is not an isolated incident. It happens all too often, and it must stop.
In September 1994, Nicholas Hayward Jr. was shot and killed in a public housing stairwell by an NYPD officer who mistook a plastic toy gun for a real one. Hayward was just 13 years old. Like so many other cases, no one was indicted in connection with the killing. In the 22 years since Hayward's death, his father has struggled with how and why his son died.
I cry a lot. It's hard to deal with losing a loved one. Nicholas was 13 years old. It pains me every time I hear of another victim being killed. My son was a great kid. He wasn't causing any harm to anyone. He was doing the right things. You know, he wasn't a danger or a threat to the officer that killed him. So, I mean, I feel that it's just something that I have to do. I have to do this. We live in a society that continues to criminalize our youth, despite the fact how much effort they put forward to try to make their own life better. My son was doing the best that he can prior to him being killed. And he told the officer, we're only playing. And he shot and killed Nicholas in mid-sentence. And despite all of the witnesses who's basically justified what Nicholas was doing, that he dropped the toy gun. They all told the district attorney he dropped the toy gun and the officer shot him anyway.
I think that actually there is a culture in police departments to protect each other, so that when they engage in the use of arbitrary power, they come together in the code of silence and refuse to allow us to find out exactly what goes on. I think they also have intimate connections to the judges and others. But I would say this, though, there's no doubt in my mind that there was an epidemic of shooting of precious, well-to-do white brothers and sisters. Police would be accountable. So even given the culture of the police departments that make it difficult for accountability to take place, it's also the fact that when it comes to poor black and brown peoples, that their lives matter less than the lives of well-to-do whites. And therefore, we have to make sure that there's fair policing rather than arbitrary policing. I think fair policing is police having a relationship with the community in which they're an organic part of that community. They are fighting crime. There's all kinds of forms of criminality, including criminality in the black community, criminality in Wall Street, criminality in professional circles and so forth. But police, unfortunately, over the years, have engaged in such massive arbitrary uses of power that the distrust cuts very, very deep. And of course, it's the backdrop of wealth inequality. It's a backdrop of a capitalist system that makes it very difficult for working peoples of any color to have their humanity affirmed. It's the backdrop of a system in which the opportunities are so limited, the decrepit school system, the massive unemployment, as well as massive underemployment. So we can't overlook the larger social context of the policing that goes on in America. But it can be much more fair than it is now.
State of emergency has been declared in the U.S. city of Baltimore after protesters clashed with police. It follows the funeral of Freddie Gray, who died in police custody over a week ago. The National Guard say that as many as 5,000 troops have been deployed amid the unrest.
Basically, since Monday, there's been a lot of speculation about what's going on out there, but basically, Freddie Gray, as we remember, we don't know why he was arrested, but he was stopped and he was arrested. And under police custody, his spine ended up being broken and he died from his injuries. So we just need to figure out what's going on, because there's a lot of things being said. We don't know if the youth, we don't know what's going on. We know that a CVS was destroyed. But I mean, with the state of the Baltimore that I knew, I don't imagine that it could be much different from how it used to be. So I am going to head out there, see what's going on, see what I can learn from it, see how I can help, how I can support, but I just can't stay here in New York and not do anything at this point. So I'm heading out there.
Breaking news from Baltimore, a city on edge since the death of a suspect while in police custody, his spine nearly severed. Tonight, those tensions fueling violent protests now. Dramatic images coming in at this hour. You can see some people on the streets there throwing rocks and bricks at police officers.
On April 19th, 2015, 23-year-old Freddie Gray Jr., an African-American man, died in a Baltimore hospital after sustaining injuries while being transported in a police van. Gray had been arrested a week before by the Baltimore Police Department for possessing what the police said was an illegal switchblade. Gray's hospitalization and subsequent death resulted in an ongoing series of protests. On April 25, 2015, a major protest in downtown Baltimore turned violent, resulting in 34 arrests and injuries to 15 police officers. After Gray's funeral on April 27th, civil disorder intensified with the looting and burning of local businesses and a drugstore, resulting in a state of emergency declared by Maryland Governor Larry Hogan. The Maryland National Guard was deployed to Baltimore, and a curfew was put into place.
I went there expecting the worst because I had seen the National Guard on TV and I had seen like how occupied they were by the military. So I was a little nervous when I got there, but surprisingly, it seemed that they were protecting mostly the harbor, the downtown harbor. That's where all of the National Guard really was, and it seemed that that was what their attention was focused on protecting. I think the media tried to kind of instill fear so that the same thing wouldn't happen in New York, but with Baltimore, it was the young children not feeling heard. It was mostly young children. All of the programs out there are cut for them. There's really nothing for them after school or part-time job-wise out there. So these children, they felt unheard, and their thing was to take to the streets. They were emotional. They started destroying, you know, things that they didn't feel were beneficial to the community.
The narrative around Baltimore, first of all, was that it was a riot. And I don't like that terminology because it's an uprising. It's cause and effect. When people are living in pervasive poverty and homelessness and joblessness, and on top of that, you add to that the current political climate where we see, not that it wasn't happening before, but where we see an overabundance of cops shooting and killing unarmed men, that was a natural response to those conditions. As with every other protest that has happened throughout this country in response to this issue, there was a negative slant put on it. They wanted to paint these people as savages instead of looking at the cause and effect. And they also didn't focus on the days that preceded what they call the riot, where people were actually in the streets peacefully protesting. So of course they're gonna spin it.
On May 21st, a grand jury indicted several of the officers involved with Gray's arrest. But in December 2015, a Baltimore judge declared a mistrial in the trial of one officer after the jury was unable to reach a verdict. The images of police wearing helmets and masks, toting assault rifles, and riding in mine-resistant armored vehicles in Baltimore and Ferguson has also raised widespread criticism of what has been dubbed the militarization of local police forces.
I think in the last 5 or 10 years, you've got the intense militarization of police departments. So the police department still engaged in arbitrary policing when I was growing up, but they didn't have the military equipment that they have now. And the very fact that the last 10 years or so, every 28 hours, there's a black or brown person who's killed by a police or security guard.
I think that military-grade equipment should be allocated to police department, but never, ever used against civilians. Military-grade equipment should be used in active shooting, shooter situations, terrorist attack, but never against a civilian unrest, and I in my mind, it was a horrible error of judgment.
We need action. By action, I mean transformation of institutions. By action, I mean redistribution of the wealth downward. By action, I mean high-quality jobs, high-quality education. By action, I mean high-quality communities where people can live with dignity. By action, I mean police who are accountable, who are punished by law if they murder other folk, arbitrarily treat other folk in ways in which they are not. So we're talking about just radical democracy. We need people's power. We need the sharing of power.
Unfortunately, I think that what we've seen with the killings of the officers in New York in 2014 and what we've seen in Dallas recently, unfortunately, I think that this is not the end of retaliation against law enforcement officers by certain individuals who feel that police profession and officers, no matter what department they come from, represent this oppressive and brutal treatment of minorities. After all, if somebody thinks about democracy and democratic principle and wanting to live in a democratic country, they have to realize that policing is a pillar of democracy. And if there are issues of concern, these issues of concern have to be discussed and have to be brought to the attention of the local politicians. But never, ever, they should be translated into any violent behavior, especially towards the ones who overall are charged with the protection of all of us.
One major goal that we have is to tie federal funding of local police forces to a prerequisite that they provide data regarding their shootings, especially in the cases of when they're shooting unarmed civilians, and then also to tie that to the mandatory use of body cameras. So that's a huge goal because I think transparency is necessary. I don't think there's enough data out there, and so that's another reason why people are able to dismiss this issue. Another goal is to have an independent prosecutor to prosecute police in cases of police violence, especially against unarmed people, because I think it will restore faith for those of us who have lost it in our criminal justice system. People believe that the grand jury system is antiquated and leaves police to kill with impunity. And so I think that this would be one way to help resolve that issue.
You know, a lot of people ask me, like, why do I protest? And because it's an ongoing problem, and I can pretend that it's not going on. I can pretend that it's not happening, but there will be a new hashtag to learn. There'll be a new face the next day. And so we continue to march and move forward and get more organized and get serious, because I don't want my children to still be marching. My grandparents marched. My mother was involved in activism work. And so I don't want to pass this along. I want to be able to tell them the story of how we overcame, how we were able to come together and fight this greater evil, and just, I don't want my children to experience it. You know, I don't want them to grow up being afraid or teaching them to be afraid of police.
You don't know when the catalyst will be in place. Why did Rosa Parks become the catalyst as opposed to the earlier black woman who sat down on the bus just a few months earlier? It's hard to say when the spark in place takes off, the fire begins to expand, intensifies, and next thing you know, you got a whole host of people on fire for justice. And lo and behold, people take off and it becomes contagious. You don't know when it's going to become contagious. It is contagious now. We are still living in the moment of Ferguson, Baltimore, and things will continue and I hope intensify.
I was told that I'm an activist from the way that I've been doing. I never thought I would be doing this type of work. I've never been the talkative type of person, this outspoken, but this made me who I am. And, you know, this is my life mission right now, like, to become an activist, become a civil rights lawyer, you know, to bring justice some way, somehow to America. This helps me. This helps me a lot. Speaking to people and being out here is more of a support than, you know, shutting down or just crying all the time. I believe that the reforms is going to happen, but I believe that it's going to take a long time. It's going to take a lot of powerful people to be on the same page. What do I fear the most? that when my daughter get older, this will still be going on with no change.
Black Lives Matter is a multiracial movement. Because if black lives matter, given the depth of white supremacy in America, then all lives will matter. Because usually it's the black lives that are the last ones that have value. But the indigenous lives will matter, the Asian lives, the white lives, the brown lives, if black lives matter. That's what makes that movement so crucial. And I'm just so very proud and blessed to be an old school brother who's a small part of that movement led by young folks.
Well, for now, it seems that police brutality and racial injustice is not going to stop in the U.S. in the near future. And statistics show that many black Americans are skeptical that their country will ever make the changes necessary for racial equality. Perhaps only time will tell if America will ever be the land of the free. And that's a wrap for this week. Hope you will join us next week for another Aperture. Goodbye for now.
This is for a better life.
فرمود بعثت لأتمم مكارم الأخلاق.
The Holy Prophet of Islam says, I have been sent to complete noble manners.
أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم. Dear brothers and sisters, assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. Welcome to For a Better Life with me, Javed Akbari, a student of the Islamic Seminary of Qom. Today we are going to talk about a question. We are going to deal with this question. Is faith without practice of any value? In the Quran, faith and pious deeds come together. Amanu wa amilu salihat. Okay? Faith, amilu salihat, means righteous actions, good deeds. So those who believe and do good deeds of righteousness, this is the literal translation of the verse of the Holy Quran, that faith and practice are intertwined, they are interconnected, they are like a needle and thread that need to work together. Otherwise, if the thread is not through the eye of the needle would not sew anything, you know. So they need to be together in order to expect that function. The Quran says, "In kuntum tuhibbun Allah fattabi'uni." In kuntum tuhibbun Allah fattabi'uni. If you love God, follow me. Surah Ali Imran, verse 31. What does this verse of the Quran mean? In kuntum tuhibbun Allah fattabi'uni. If you love God, then you have to follow me. Okay. It means that if you have faith in God, if you believe that God is one and that He is the creator, He is the sustainer, then you have to follow Him. Many people say that, okay, they have faith, but they are not practicing people. How can you justify faith without practice? They are so closely intertwined with each other.
And those people who say they have faith but they do not practice, and there are many such people, of course, I have seen many people in my life, people who just say, "Oh Allah, oh God," who just, talk about God, but they do not offer prayers, they do not fast, they do not perform pilgrimage of the house of God, and they do not practice or fulfill many other obligatory duties. It seems that you cannot reconcile between faith and this and the said. You cannot justify. How can you believe in God? How can you love God and you do not obey him? Every lover obeys the beloved, okay? So those people who say that they believe in God, but they do not practice and they do not speak to him and they do not pray, they claim that the love of the commander of the faithful, and they say, okay, they love Imam Ali alayhi salatu wasalam, and they believe and they say that Imam Ali is in their hearts, but in practice they are in no way similar to him. They, for example, say that they believe in the Imam of Time, Imam al-Asr, ajjalallahu ta'ala farajahu sharif, yet they do not pay his rights that are obligatory upon them. So how can they prove that they love God, they love the Imams, they love the Holy Prophet, and they love the Imam of Age, but they do not nothing, they do not fulfill the obligatory duties? So faith and practice are intertwined. If one's actions do not represent what he claims to believe in, then one should doubt his honesty and the genuineness of his claim. This is actually the nutshell. This is to make a long story short.
We changed the desert into oases. We built buildings of different lengths and sizes, and we felt so very satisfied. We bought and bought and couldn't stop buying. We gave charity to the poor cause we couldn't stand the crying. We thought we paid our dues, but in fact to ourselves we're just lying. Oh, I'm walking with my head lowered in shame for my place. I'm walking with my head lowered for my race. Yes, it's easy to blame everything on the West, when in fact our focus should be on ourselves. I'm walking with my head lowered in shame for my place. I'm walking with my head lowered for my race. Yes, it's easy to blame everything on the West, when in fact our focus should be on ourselves. Is it satisfied? Is Allah satisfied? Is Allah satisfied?
Let me give you another example. In the past, when wars were fought and won, prisoners of war were sold to others as slaves. The more skilled the slave was, the higher the purchase price was. One day a slave was brought to the market with a very high price tag. When a purchaser asked why, he was told that the slave was able to detect who was thirsty and who was not. The purchaser was attracted to that skill and bought the slave, okay? Now the question is, that the story is this, that someone, a slave, was brought to the market, and it was claimed that the slave was able to detect who was thirsty and who was not. So the person who wanted to purchase a slave, he was interested. He got attracted to that skill. So he approached, went ahead and bought the slave. So he then invited his friends over to dine, but did not present them with any water. After some time, one of the invitees requested water. The owner looked upon the slave, but the slave said that his guest was lying, that he was not actually thirsty. Slowly, more and more people started to claim thirst, but the slave continued to belie them until one of the guests got up to get some water. At that point, the slave said to his master that the guest was truly thirsty because he got up from his place and obtained the water himself rather than just claiming to be thirsty. So someone who is truthful actually takes practical steps to acquire what he is looking for. You cannot claim to be a lover unless you seek your love, unless you take practical action to obey the beloved. And he who is not a man of practice can only make the claim of having faith, you know. So, unfortunately, we do come across a lot of such people who claim to believe in God. But let me tell you one thing. Of course, the belief in God is one thing. It could be just a claim made by some people, you know. And another thing that we can say is also to accept that faith has different grades, different degrees, you know. You cannot compare a layman's faith and belief and conviction with that of a noble figure, with a noble, let's say, scholar, and that of a noble scholar with the imams, with the faith of the imams. See, the faith, the level, the degrees of faith differ. Someone might have faith, but the faith is not strong enough to provoke him, to make him take action, to look for pleasing God, to comply with his orders, and to implement what he is expected to. So, to conclude, I would say that faith and practice are intricated, they are intertwined, and they cannot be separated from each other. And those who actually make claims that they have faith in God, they are not true believers. They are not faithful in the real sense of the word. And true faith means that one jumps into action, takes action, fulfills what he is supposed to and what he is commanded to do. He complies with God's order. He complies with the injunctions and with the ordinances of Allah. He does not do anything which displeases Allah. So faith and practice are intertwined. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Your mercy, your love is on our knees. So all I need, so all I need, so all I need.
Iranian Radio, Global Mission. This is IRIB English Radio.
This is A to Z. Introduction to Islamic Lifestyle. Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. In the name of Allah, the Most Beneficent, the Most Merciful. Dear brothers and sisters, Assalamu alaikum. Peace and blessings of Allah be upon you all. This is A to Z, coming to you from IRIB English Radio, and I'm your host, Ali. This radio show is about Islamic lifestyle, and in each episode, we will be talking about a different lesson. Please stay with us till the end of today's program. Today's lesson, The American Dream. Brothers and sisters, we know that Islam is a religion that is universal in nature, and we know Islam is going to be triumph in the end. It is a religion for the oppressed masses. It is the religion of justice, of social justice, of bringing peace and prosperity where people can grow spiritually and materially. Now, in this century, though, where means of communication and transportation have gone beyond all expectations, cross-cultural awareness has become widespread. And with the collapse of communism and consequently the Soviet Union and many other communist countries, many proposals are being presented urging the adoption of universal laws, values, and morals to govern relationships among the peoples of the world. Recently, the idea of so-called New World Order was proposed through the United Nations in order to prescribe values and impose laws on people of various cultures. The question that will immediately emerge is, whose values, laws, and the ways of life are they going to adopt? Of course, the American way of life will become the only choice presented, because the United States is presently the only superpower among all the nations of the world, as well as the largest financial contributor to the United Nations. But guess what? This system does not seem to be holding up too well. And this is why we are saying that no, it is going to be the new Islamic civilization that is going to provide humanity with that platform that takes them towards prosperity and felicity in both the worlds. Welcome back, dear listeners. Today we're talking about the American dream and how America is planning to and is wanting to and is aiming to rule the entire planet world. We said that America doesn't seem to be in that position anymore. It could be a dream a while ago, but now it doesn't seem like to be a viable dream. Now you look at the economic situation of the U.S., for instance. Since 2008, America's national debt has surged nearly 200%, reaching $27 trillion as of October 2020. Well, to gain a better understanding of this ever-growing debt, we have to, you know, open up the whole research closet, you know, where we look at like the details and breakdowns of what is going on and is happening with the American economy. But the economists throughout the world, they are suspecting and they're anticipating a collapse of the artificial economic growth that the United States of America has been able to generate, create, and is the core and sole reason why it can dream to rule the world. Now, this was the economic situation. What about the social situation, the social fabric of the United States of America? You look at their conditions. social conditions, homeless people, you know, divorce rate. You look at the rapes. You look at, like, you know, just stealing and gangsters and the mobs and stuff. You see that society socially is collapsing, if not has already collapsed. Political situation, the democracy, the liberal democracy, nobody wishes to have it anymore. You know, it's just a failed model that the world has witnessed, that the last 200 years of social democracy have been a disaster for the entire world. Bottom line is that the U.S. is in no position to lead the world, and the Islamic civilization, the new Islamic civilization, is something that we need to read up on, and that is the second phase of the Islamic Revolution, a manifesto that the leader of the Islamic Republic, the leader of the Islamic Revolution and Islamic Ummah has issued. It's available on Khamenei.ir. Go take a read, and this is what the future looks like. Dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, thank you very much for staying with us till the end of today's episode of A to Z. Don't forget to log on to our website at www.parstoday.com, Call of Islam page. We leave you all in the care of Allah. Till next time, wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Coronavirus pandemic has become an endless nightmare for much of the world. Despite the development and distribution of a range of new vaccines, many countries are still struggling to battle the deadly waves of the highly transmissible disease. As the world steps up efforts to contain the deadly virus, new variants are rapidly replacing older versions, making the situation even more frightening. Many thousands of people lose their lives every day worldwide, despite restrictive measures that have paralyzed economies. The pandemic could get much worse before it gets better. The world is undoubtedly eager to find out how the whole thing began so that future risks can be minimized. The origin of COVID-19 has been a major bone of contention, especially between the world's worst coronavirus-hit country, the United States, and China, where the deadly virus was first detected in December 2019. The two sides have exchanged barbs over the origin of the crisis. Now all eyes are focused on a fact-finding mission on the origins of the pandemic. A team of scientists from the World Health Organization is right now in the Chinese city of Wuhan trying to find out the origins of the outbreak. The WHO says its fact-finding mission in Wuhan is purely scientific. But the probe is facing a political minefield. The World Health Organization team will carry out on-the-ground investigations into the source of the new coronavirus. The WHO scientists will visit different places in Wuhan and talk to people and officials. The WHO says all hypotheses are on the table during the probe. The WHO team is expected to inspect a seafood market in Wuhan, which was linked to many of the first COVID-19 cases in December 2019. The scientists will also visit hospitals that treat coronavirus patients in the city. But how much will the team of investigators be able to uncover? The WHO experts face a tough task as the city has been repeatedly disinfected. The investigation is ongoing in Wuhan, but there have been cautions against expecting any breakthroughs soon. It could take years before any firm conclusions can be reached. What's making the WHO mission even tougher is the fact that it has been highly politicized. Several countries, particularly the United States, accused the Chinese government of hiding the outbreak's severity during its early stages. The administration of former U.S. President Donald Trump kept criticizing China for alleged failures in containing the